Good morning. A little bit of tweaking to the vaccine rollout, because on Wednesday, Chief Clinical Officer at the HSE, Colm Henry, said this on the News at One.
We've seen the advice come through from the EMA, and it's been the advice has been carried by France and Italy and other European countries, that based on the current evidence we have, and bear in mind, we're dealing with evolving evidence all the time, not just from the trials, but from on the field experience. The advice generally is to give this what's called the mRNA vaccines, namely the Moderna or the Pfizer, to preferentially give those to older people, because based on the evidence we have right now, it affords them greater protection. That may change in time. We see new evidence from the AstraZeneca vaccine showing good efficacy in the UK over those people vaccinated. But at this point in time, the advice we're getting from the EMA through NIAC is to preferentially give those that Pfizer Moderna vaccine to the over 70s, and we're beginning that in mid-February.
So we're holding off on the AstraZeneca for people aged over 70, not because it's not safe, mind you, but because we need more data on its efficacy. On Thursday morning, Claire spoke to GP Yvonne Williams and Paul Moyna, Professor of Immunology at Maynooth University, and she read this text.
I'm 69 and I will not take AstraZeneca. And that's what's going to happen now, isn't it? Because people are going to see that questions are being raised about the trials.
I think that's the danger, and that's why just a coordinated message, I think, from NIAC, from the HSE, from NEFID and from the Minister is just really important, just to get the message out. All three vaccines are safe. All three are effective, much more effective than flu vaccine and other vaccines we give every year. AstraZeneca in particular, there was data yesterday showing it reduces spread transmission to other people, you know, by up to 2/3. So that's wonderful. You know, that's the first time we've had that level of evidence. So if there's any vaccine offered to you, I would be saying to take it, and that's what I would be advising my own patients and families.
In terms of the if you look across all of these three vaccines and a number of the vaccines, in terms of their efficacy, they're all really highly impressive in terms of protecting against serious illness and death and even moderate disease. There's some differences in terms of protection against milder disease and potentially asymptomatic infection, but they're all really effective, essentially 100% protection against severe disease and hospitalisation. So I think that should be highlighted
okay.
as well.
But what impact on the vaccine rollout programme? Here's Health Minister Stephen Donnelly on yesterday's News at One.
What's the new plan?
Well, to be honest, there's not that much change from the patient's perspective. Obviously, there are some logistical changes that have to be made. But from the patient's perspective, things will be proceeding largely as planned. So for the nursing homes, we're continuing with Pfizer and Moderna as planned. And most of dose two will have been done by the end of this month. Cohort two, the frontline healthcare workers we've just talked about. And then the third group is those 70 and older, and we're starting with those aged 85 and older. And we're commencing that as planned the week of the 15th of February. It's going to still be done through the GP practices.
But there's been, for example, suggestions that GPs, particularly smaller practices, would come together to pool their resources to deal with this, that there would be specially set up temporary centres to vaccinate people. How far down the road have you got, and the HSE got, to actually putting those plans into some sort of concrete effect?
Yeah, so it's exactly as you've said, Brian. So about 70% of GP practices will be able to do this work at their clinics. And then there's a remaining amount. It's about 400 practices. And the HSE and the IMO are talking with them to implement local solutions. In some cases, those smaller practices will come together. In some cases, they'll come to a centre in a town or a village. And in some cases, they'll work with some of the larger GP practices as well.
But none of those centres, have they been identified at this stage, for example?
I'm not sure exactly at a local level for the 400. I know the larger vaccination clinics, obviously, a lot of work has been done on them. But the local solutions are being worked through at the moment with the IMO and with the practices themselves.
And what, pray tell, about the cold storage needs for the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines?
There are more logistics involved. But remember, the Pfizer vaccine, when you take it out of these super fridges at minus 70 degrees, they're fine in a fridge for 5 days. And in fact, the Moderna vaccine is fine in a fridge for 30 days. So the rollout program, from the patient's perspective, they're really not going to see much difference. And as we said, you know, about 7 in every 10 GP practices around the country are simply going to do it from their own practices, just like they would have if it was AstraZeneca.
We shall see. Health Minister Stephen Donnelly on the News at One yesterday. Now, last weekend, blunder, gaffe, snafu, diplomatic boo-boo. But when the EU attempted to control vaccine exports and invoked Article 16 of the Northern Ireland Protocol, consternation and agitation. No matter that they rode back on it that same evening, the genie was out of the bottle. The start of the week saw Brexit tensions make the front page when threats to staff working at Belfast and Larne ports led to suspension of customs checks. Now, by the end of the week, the PSNI chief constable would say that there was no intelligence suggesting loyalist paramilitary violence, and he appealed for calm. But make no mistake, Brexit is back and as tricky as ever. Sam McBride, political editor of the Belfast Newsletter, joined Clare on Tuesday, and he detailed the day-to-day impact of this new reality.
The reality of that border, prices increasing, goods not appearing on shelves, companies increasingly saying they're not sending items to Northern Ireland, no matter what people are prepared to pay for them. And then some really ludicrous examples, British soil being banned for the first time from Northern Ireland, the armed forces being told they can't move to Northern Ireland with their equipment without getting EU permission. There was just a very long list of things here that said to people who constitutionally look towards Britain, this is a very significant development. You have no say in this democratically, and they didn't see any way to get out of it.
And if you want to bring farm machinery into Northern Ireland, it better be squeaky clean and free of soil. This digger did not pass the test.
It was turned back because it hadn't been sufficiently washed. Then after it was washed again, there was soil apparently found in the cab, and it was turned back again. I spoke to a specialist, Hollier, who deals in second-hand agricultural machinery, diggers, tractors, ploughs, things like that. And he said that it has always been the case that there is a requirement to wash equipment before it crosses the Irish Sea to Northern Ireland. However, now there is this much more bureaucratic process where you have to get something called a wash certificate. It has to be done to an incredibly high specification, and parts of the machine have to be disassembled and to wash behind hitches and things like that. He says that has added about £200 already to the cost of second-hand agricultural equipment crossing the Irish Sea. So, I mean, there are so many of these various parts of the story. It's a border which really touches on almost every aspect of life in Northern Ireland. And I think that is the thing that, after years of Brexit being this amorphous, very technical, very boring thing, suddenly the person in the street in Northern Ireland realises, this is impacting my life. And there's nothing I can do about it democratically.
Reality bites.
Indeed. Now, the DUP want to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol entirely. The UK government want changes, which they set out in a letter to the EU. And on Wednesday, they had a virtual meeting to discuss the proposals. Here's Tony Connolly on Thursday's Morning Ireland.
Well, Anya, they made demands for sweeping changes to the protocol, extensions to grace periods. They wanted the trusted trader scheme to be expanded to take in a whole swathe of the commercial sector. They wanted, Michael Gove in his letter wanted concessions on seed potatoes, on a whole range of horticultural products. And he wanted these grace periods that already exist for meat and animal product imports to be extended all the way till the 1st of January 2023. The tone of his letter yesterday was basically we need agreement on this week, or effectively the UK will take unilateral measures. And of course, we heard in the House of Commons yesterday from Boris Johnson what unilateral measure might look like. It might be the UK itself triggering Article 16. So the letter from Michael Gove to the European Commission yesterday, well, it landed on Tuesday night, has come as quite of a shock, quite a shock to EU officials who have privately expressed real dismay that the UK is using what happened last Friday with Article 16 and COVID vaccines and so on as a pretext now to potentially triggering Article 16 themselves, or certainly launching a more concerted assault on the Northern Ireland Protocol.
Now, all sides have reiterated their commitment to the protocol and to deal with the problems that have arisen as a result of it. However, the DUP's Arlene Foster still believes Boris Johnson has her back and the protocol can and should be scrapped.
Simon Coveney is just confirming what a lot of us in Northern Ireland believe, and that is that he is completely tone deaf to the concerns of unionism, and he claims to support the Belfast Agreement, but the balance in the Belfast Agreement doesn't seem to matter. We'll just carry on regardless of the fact that there's not one unionist politician in Northern Ireland that supports the protocol, but what about it? Nothing to see here. We'll just move along. That's the attitude, not just of Simon Coveney and the Irish government, regrettably, but after yesterday's meeting with the European Union, it appears to be their view as well.
Arlene Foster speaking on the BBC this morning. And I suppose, Tommy, it leaves us, the DUP, with this dilemma, doesn't it? They were told by everybody else that Brexit would be bad for Northern Ireland. They backed it. They didn't back Theresa May's deal. They backed Boris, who promised no Irish Sea border and then delivered one. I suppose the question now is, and Arlene Foster, judging from those comments in that article today, seems to believe that Boris will still back the DUP on scrapping the protocol, even though he doesn't need their votes in the House of Commons anymore.
Well, I think she's certainly backing on the concept that she will be able to exert further pressure on the British Prime Minister to move towards her side of the argument that, you know, there's the ERG, there's Tory heartland, hence the article in the Daily Telegraph. I think what's really important to take into consideration here is the pressure within the DUP itself. From the right of the party, and I think that's reflected in the stance of Arlene Foster in recent times. There are real difficulties there, and Áine, I think we have some more of this headbutting and sharp elbow behaviour for a number of weeks, and then let's see when the European Commission Vice President comes to London next week. Let's see what sort of practical measures will be suggested. But certainly, I don't see this controversy ending in the next week or two. I think it's going to continue.
Tommy Gorman with Áine on Thursday's Morning Ireland. Brexit. It's never going to go away, is it? Back in a bit. Welcome back. The HIV/AIDS pandemic of the 1980s is within living memory for most of us. But a Channel 4 drama called It's a Sin is set in the era of shoulder pads and snow-washed denim, and it has acted as a reminder of the devastation of the disease for the gay community and the prejudice and bigotry they faced at that time. On Monday, Ryan spoke to Ruth Coker Burks about her memoir, All the Young Men. She's from Arkansas, and she talked about how, when she was 26, a visit to a local hospital in 1986 changed her life when she saw how one patient was being treated.
They put up a big red bag across the door that said biohazard. Mm-hmm. And then I noticed his food trays started ending up on the floor out in the hallway. And they wouldn't go in. They were drawing straws to see who would go in and check on him. And I just couldn't believe my eyes. And so they would draw straws, and then they would, you know, kind of giggle and draw again and then completely ignore Jimmy. And I just couldn't take it any longer. And I snuck into his room after they walked away to go and, deal with other patients. And so I walked in, and he was so frail and so thin and weak, I couldn't tell him from the bed sheets.
And what did you find out about this poor young fella?
Well, I asked him if there was anything I could do for him, and he said he wanted his mama. And I thought, well, I can do that. So I told him that I would go and call his mother. I went out to the nurse's station, and they laughed. They kind of backed up away from me like I was a horror movie, and they said, you didn't go in that room, did you? And I'm like, well, yeah, I did. And they go, honey, nobody's coming. He's been here 6 weeks. His mama's not coming. Nobody's coming. I couldn't believe my ears. So I, you know, asked for his mother's number, and they reluctantly gave it to me. And, you know, I reached for their telephone that I'd been using for, you know, 5 years, and they said, oh, no, the payphone's down the hall. So I went down the hall with all the pride I could muster, and I called her, and she said, I don't have a son. I don't know what that thing is you have up there, but my son died years ago when he went gay. Don't call me back. And hung up on me.
Now, she rang the woman back, but to no avail.
And she said, don't even call me back when it dies. And I went back in his room not knowing, I mean, what do you go in and tell someone whose mother is not coming? I mean, what do you do? So I went back in and I took his hand and he looked up at me and he said, oh, Mama, I knew you'd come. He thought I was his mother. And I let him think that. Yeah. And I said, well, honey, I'm here. I'm here and I'm going to stay with you. And so I did for 13 hours until he died.
And when he died, Ruth took it upon herself to make sure he was given a fitting burial.
I called the city cemetery and the man goes, oh, I don't want any of them AIDS juices in my cemetery. And the other families would get real mad if it leaked down into their graves. I mean, this was cremated remains.
Right.
And so anyway, I took him and I buried him on top of my daddy's grave.
Yourself?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. No one would go with me. And I couldn't even find a preacher that would say a kind word or an unkind word over a pile of dirt. So I took him and I buried him in my family cemetery and he's there safely today.
And thus began her involvement, helping people ill with HIV and burying those who died, often when their families, communities and churches would have nothing to do with them.
Do you think that the families who very ostentatiously shunned their sons during the AIDS crisis, are they living with the guilt or their own shame, or do they take it to the grave with them, or do they feel we did right by our God and right by our morals?
You know, I really don't know because I never heard from any of the families after I buried their children.
How many children did you bury? How many men did you bury?
You know, I've buried over 40.
Did one member of any of the family, extended or otherwise, from those 40 men's families, contact you to say thank you for giving dignity to our boy?
I had one.
One.
And that was Misty McCall, Rick Norton, but his drag name was Misty McCall. And so his mother called the night before the funeral and asked if she could come. And I told her, yes, she could come. I didn't know how people would treat her, but she was welcome to come. And, you know, they treated her like she had been with him the whole time and she wouldn't come when he was dying. And that's how loving and forgiving the LGBT community is.
Ruth Coker-Burks with Ryan on Monday. And on Wednesday, Ray spoke to gay rights campaigners Tony Walsh and David Norris. And David Norris recalled the difficulty of getting proper care for people who were ill here in Ireland and a fitting burial.
Undertakers, for example, were very chary about accepting the bodies of people who had died from AIDS, and they were kind of put them in black plastic bags and all this kind of stuff.
And St. James's Hospital was the place where all the AIDS victims were treated.
Yes, and there was a very fine consultant there, the first AIDS consultant, Dr. Fiona Mulcahy, and I got the first debate on AIDS. The Dáil were afraid to consider it at all. And I brought Fiona Mulcahy in and Father Paul Lavelle, who dealt with drug users. And I said, I'm just here to chair the meeting. Ask any of the most ignorant and bigoted questions you want, and let's get all the poison out. So we did that, and it was very good, very free and very frank. And as a result, we had a very, very good, very clear, unemotional discussion about AIDS in the Senate.
And activist Tony Walsh, too, played a massive role in education and advocacy. But now, almost 40 years later, having lived through those dark days and survived, what perspective does he have on that time now?
Tony, one of the characters you've seen, It's a Sin, and one of the characters, he's the main character, Richie, when he's on his deathbed and he's talking to his mother, who is finding it very difficult to deal with the fact that her son is gay and that he has this terminal illness, he says to her, "But you have to remember, I had fun."
Mm. Well, here's the thing: we did, and we had to. I think we without realising it, we were also having fun as a coping mechanism.
Right.
We had to find a way to get through this, and at the time we buried our grief, and well, we tried to focus our anger as much as possible on remedying the worst effects of the disease and how it played out on people. Having to you providing practical support and whatnot, showing compassion to people in some cases who'd been kicked out of their houses when their parents or family found out they had AIDS, just disowned them. I spent all of my 20s in the AIDS pandemic, and I have to say it's only now that I'm coming to terms with the distress that it caused me. I feel closer to it now than I did at any time during it, and I'm not sure why that's the case. Is it possibly because I'm much older, I'm sliding towards mortality or something? But also I just think that with the examples of It's a Sin and other cultural offerings, we're beginning to excavate that period, and we're also beginning to excavate it with a tad more compassion and concern and understanding of what people went through. And I now look back and I marvel at how AIDS changed us. AIDS changed us as a society, gay and heterosexual people. It taught us lessons about care, most of us, if we were prepared to listen. It taught us something about care and compassion, about looking after people who were marginalised.
Tony Walsh with Ray. And back to Rory O'Neill, aka Panty Bliss, with Miriam on Sunday. Now, he's been living with HIV for years now, and he's very anxious to stress that it's no longer the death sentence it used to be. Not at all. But he talked about getting the news way back in 1995.
When I was diagnosed, I was told by the consultant that I probably had, you know, I had 1 to 5 years to live. And, you know, and when she told me that, I was very aware of what those 1 to 5 years were going to be like, that they were going to be horrible and hidden and grasping and marked and all of that stuff, because I'd seen it so often already in friends of mine. And for example, when I went to my first visit at the clinic in St. James's, shout out to all the staff in St. James's Guy Clinic, they're amazing. You know, I saw the consultant. She persuaded me to start taking medication because at the time, a lot of people were terrified of the medications because they came with horrible side effects. And of course, at that time, they weren't really saving people. So people were reluctant to take them. And then I left her office and I go straight in next door into the social worker's office, where a social worker sort of held my hand across the table and told me all the ways that they could make dying easier. You know, I'd get a blanket allowance and a nutrition allowance and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it was absolutely assumed that I was going to be dead in a couple of years, that I wouldn't be able to work anymore. And they had this sort of conveyor belt set up that would make things as comfortable as possible for you as it trundled you off to the grave. I mean, it was absolutely terrifying.
Now, though, it's a very different story.
Of course, the times have changed so dramatically, and there's no need for anyone to die of AIDS anymore. People can still die of ignorance, unfortunately, but not of AIDS. Because treatments have advanced so incredibly, science has been wonderful, and nowadays people like me get on and live our lives and take one pill a day and get on with it. So it's amazing, the show, and it is great to know where we came from and to remember what we've been through. But things are not the same anymore. So I would hate to feel that somebody is sitting somewhere in their living room watching that and thinking that things are the same. They're not.
Rory O'Neill with Miriam on Sunday. So many voices there recalling the AIDS pandemic in the 1980s, sparked by that drama, It's a Sin. Back in a bit. Welcome back. If you find yourself coming out with words and phrases that make you sound as if you were born and reared in Santa Monica and not Enniscrone, while it might be tempting to blame the telly, the American soaps or YouTube, That's not it. It's normal language evolution, not necessarily the end of civilization as we know it. Here's UCD's Professor of Linguistics, Vera Regan, with Claire.
This purist thing has always existed. People have always been really, really nervous about change, about anything that's incoming, that's not what they've always been used to doing.
I just wonder why it's so annoying, though.
Yeah, well, the grating thing is the threat, I suspect. First of all, there's the cross between generations. Old people can't talk to young people, and that's not new. There's always been a discomfort. But linguists get a bit impatient with this because they say, goodness, can't we see that language is still healthy and is still robust, and that really the people who make the laws about language are usually middle-aged people. They're not young people. They're not the people who are doing the actual change. And change is always brought about by young people, actually.
Tell that to texter Elaine.
Elaine in Galway, the upward inflection at the end of the sentence drives me insane.
Yeah, it's so funny. So there are some of those things that kind of leap out. They're little quirks that we hear as American type stuff, and the rising intonation at the end of a declarative sentence. I got it in Zara. I was there at 5. My mates are with me. Or the
do you know what I blame for that, right?
Yeah,
Australian soaps. I remember that coming into how we spoke when we were 10, 11, 12, Home and Away and Neighbours. That's where it started for me. That was the first time I noticed it.
It's possible, Claire, that there was some influence, but I'm afraid that there's no evidence in the linguistics research which actually proves that it was the TV.
Another thing,
I'll tell you what happened probably was, you notice something that was really, really noticeable. It's salient. It sticks out. It's like a little nail in a floor and you want to hammer it down, but because it's just one of those things that sticks up, we notice it. The big structure of the language is not changing.
And if we do take on a verbal tick, we make it our own, like.
For instance, we did some research on the use of like, and what we discovered was that, there was huge use of this be like. I was like, never. Or he was like 10 foot tall with joy. Now, that's an American use. But what happened was when like came into Ireland, we started using it in our own way. Yeah, we use it a lot, but we use it in a different way. So we'll say stuff like, we'll put the like at the end of the phrase. So we're only having a few pints like.
Mm. I notice my own children using like a lot and actually a lot. And then I catch myself doing it. So the question is, are they picking that up from social media and media, or are they picking it up from me? And it's probably me. Like,
it's probably you, Claire, because mothers, caregivers, they're the people who actually transmit language and language change. You got to watch yourself.
Okay.
As if the mammies didn't have enough to be worrying about. On Monday, there was a very small storm around the use of Health Minister Stephen Donnelly's thumbs up emoji to Tony Houlihan. Was it simply all understood and all okay, or a passive aggressive symbol designed to snub? Lise Hand took on the task of dissecting the story and emoji etiquette for drive time.
A great bit of sport for everybody online. I mean, you know, I'm like, I don't think anybody, in all honesty, could be massively outraged by the story. I mean, you know, if you want to take it in the broader context, the fact that he used the emoji in the middle of a very fraught back and forth with Tony Houlihan, maybe that's to question. But I mean, you know, the thing is, I mean, to go back to your question, I use emojis.
Do you?
And I had a quick look. Yeah, I had a quick look just before I came on air to have a look and see my most frequently used ones, which, of course, are the ones on the very left hand side of your emoji thing. And they're in pride of place, number one spot was the thumbs up emoji.
Oh.
Like followed by, you know, the dog, superwoman, guitar, glass of wine, eye roll face, and the pair of eyes, which I love. So,
well, Lise,
that is quite the insight.
Lise, you know who's the most passive aggressive among us here? Sarah McInerney.
Well, well,
I do also use it quite a lot.
Tense face emoji in Studio 10, and then Sarah explained her love-hate relationship with the thumbs up.
you know, as Cormac say, it says, I do use it now quite a lot because people were using it to me and I just sort of picked it up. But then when I stopped and thought about it over the last couple of hours, it did occur to me that whenever I get the thumbs up emoji, I do feel a little bit like the other person's being a bit short, maybe. Like, could they not have given me a smiley face or an okay or a thanks or a see you then? You know, am I only worth the one press of the button? Like, are they that busy? You know, there is a sort of a shortness to it. And I say that as somebody who uses them quite a lot.
Thumbs up, or at least. Thumbs up.
Unicorn, smiley face, penguin. But these guys, no.
If there was only one golden rule I would suggest to people who aren't very familiar is stay the hell away from food emojis. That is a minefield.
Lee's hand on drive time. And if you don't know why, we're not going to tell you. And now, finally, to what was probably the radio highlight of the week. Liveline, Thursday. Because while the rest of us were looking out the window, waiting for the snow that's due, Frank and Una were basking in the warm Spanish sun. They phoned in to Joe from Gran Canaria. Una went on a one-way ticket on January 13th, Frank just after Christmas. Both travelled with negative COVID tests. Both say that the COVID numbers there are very low, and in their view, they're safer there than they would be here, particularly in Frank's case, as he has an underlying health condition. And as for their mental health, Joe opened up the faders and asked them both to paint us a picture.
And what's the weather like there today?
Oh, Joe, beautiful. Beautiful. Just what you would want.
Well, describe your surroundings. What can you see? Blue sky?
Blue sky. I'm in a private complex. Okay. Where my apartment is, and I have a beautiful sealed off with glass pool heated, and all walks around the surrounding beautiful shrubbery, everything just as you would see in a magazine book.
And can you use it?
I have my own patio where I have my lounger and my seating and my table where I can have my breakfast outdoors.
And can you use the swimming pool? Yes.
Oh, yes. Okay. Oh, yes. Yes. It's for the residents here. It's in a private complex.
Una, the cost of living?
It's about half what I would pay for my groceries at home. I can get. And here, the wine that I drink here is Sangria de Toro, which I can buy at home all the time. And it is less than half the price here, Joe. I buy a bottle of water. I buy a bottle of wine as well. I was down the beach yesterday, and when I on my way back, there's a lovely little coffee place where I had a coffee and a cognac for €4.80. Now, and the brandy they bring you is the local brandy, which is really nice, and they bring it to you in a warmed glass before they empty it out to pour in the brandy.
And what's the measure?
But you will not get that service. Oh, it's huge. You have to tell them when to stop.
Una, Una, Una. Not to be outdone, here comes Frank.
I'm in an apartment that we rent, and I'm looking up at, it's in a valley, and I'm looking up at mountains on both sides. And this year, the mountains, for the first time since we've been coming, they're green. It's nearly like Ireland. There's green vegetation on the sides. It goes up to about... maybe 1,500 feet, I'd say, on each side of the valley that we're in. So we're in this...
Sounds incredible. And Frank, if you had been stopped on the way to the airport, which technically you shouldn't have been going to under the rules and regulations, would you have turned back, or would you have said, well, I'll pay the fine, but I'd pay
the fine, Joe. I think my health and my sanity is more important than the 100 quid.
And talk to me then about your sanity. What does it mean in terms of your daily routine in Gran Canaria?
Well, every second day, we always have breakfast out in the terrace.
Yeah.
And then every second day, we go for a hike in the hills.
Right.
Maybe up to yesterday now, we did 10 kilometres. And climbing up from 0 to 500 feet. Now, we're both the wrong side of 70, so we're no chickens. So that's, and then we come back and we either eat in a local restaurant or my wife cooks and we have dinner out on the terrace.
Now let's just take a minute to pause and pose the question. Had Frank and Una ever actually heard Liveline? Because if they came on the air thinking the callers were going to say, do you know something, isn't that great for you? Bon voyage. No, more likely, blood on the terrace and in your cognac.
I'm appalled. I think those people are a disgrace, an absolute disgrace. They're talking about, you know, their mental health. What about the what about the remainder of the country? What about our mental health? People are ill all the time. People are dying. And the point about it is that is never going to change if we have people like those couples that are on the air now talking to you, Joe.
In comes Frank.
Well, I'd like to mention that. I mean, by me staying in Ireland, it wouldn't have done much. It'd just make me miserable. And I think if Mary, I feel for Mary. She sounds upset and sounds stressed. And Mary, all I can say to you, get a flight out here and you'll feel much better.
How dare you? How dare you? No.
You would.
Because can I speak, please? Because this is part of what you said. No, I won't get a flight out. Yes, I would love to. But the point about it is we will adhere to the rules. We will always follow the rules that are made in the hope that, please God, someday, you know, that this terrible, terrible virus will go and that we will be able to get back to normality. Stressed. I think the whole country is stressed, apart from yourselves that can gallivant off on these holidays. Regardless of your age or health or anything else, you know, I think you're being extremely selfish and I think you should cop on and think of all the people in the country that, yes, you know, are stressed and, yes, are frustrated and, yes, they just want this nightmare to end.
Next up, Pather.
I'm amazed that you have these people on the radio promoting the fact that they've gone abroad on holidays. Now, I hope that Frank and Una, when they return to Ireland, that their names will red flag and that they'll pick up another €500 fine. That's what I think, yeah.
Who's that laughing? Una?
I give a little guffaw as well. Well, I hope not.
I hope it's red flagged, Frank, and I hope you get a €500 fine because you deserve every penny of it.
And they just kept coming. Here's Jackie.
I'm livid here. I really am, sitting at my remote desk for I don't know how long, but I just think, how dare they come on national radio and actually boast about this? You know, we've all made huge sacrifices. And, you know, they're all nearly sneering and rubbing our noses.
I wouldn't have heard that now, Jackie.
Well, you know, I just think rules are rules.
Yeah, I'd say that as regards to rules, nobody was more compliant with rules than me back in Ireland.
But you broke it.
We didn't. Let me finish, sorry. We haven't seen our kids since Christmas. We haven't seen our grandchild since Christmas. We talk to them on Zoom and we talk to them over the phone and we can do that here. But the difference is by doing it here, we are safer ourselves and we've got less chance of catching the virus.
So look after yourself and never mind about the rest of us. So
no,
that's okay. We've been asked to do this together. We've been asked to abide by rules and regulations together. But you decided you actually know better than the medical experts and the government and you took the law into your own hands.
I just use my head.
Here's Una off the Sun Lounger with her defence.
I'm very sorry for the people that begrudge us being out here. I don't think that lady have been listening to Professor Luke O'Neill, who has told us in an aeroplane is the safest place you could be.
But Luke O'Neill didn't tell you to break the rules and leave.
Because I am here, I am saving you.
Yeah, but you're not.
You're not saving me.
I am, because I'm out here, I'm saving everybody else at home.
No, oh, I listen, Una, not really. Don't try and become the saviour of Ireland. You're not the saviour of Ireland. No, you're not.
No, I'm not passing it on to anybody.
Haruna, bloody but unbowed. Now, as well as the anger you can hear, there was also pain. Callers rang in to tell of the difficulties they had faced in obeying the rules. Not being able to hug their children with special needs, attend funerals of loved ones, and working in the health service to care for people dying of COVID-19. There was, however, one lone voice of support, Kate. She thought that maybe, just maybe, what Una and Frank had done was kind of understandable, perhaps even forgivable. None of us are getting any younger, carpe diem, and all of that. But generally, not a good run out for Frank and Una. So, would the two be sheepishly hiding out under their sombreros? Yeah, not so much.
Una and Frank, Una, first. Una, what time is it there now? It's 2:55 here.
It's the same as at home, Frank.
Okay. And what will you do for the rest of the day?
Well, when I digest everything that happened today, I think I might go for a stroll and go back down for my cafe and cognac again.
Okay. And Frank, what would you do for the rest of the day?
This program has broken into our walking schedule, so we'll have a late walking schedule. We'll go for a walk. Okay.
Liveline on Thursday. Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.